Hello there everyone, and thank you for tuning into the MEL 2.0 series of AMPUL, the Australian Medical Students Association's podcast. My name is Melinda Fernando, and I will be your host for today's episode with special guest Dr. Peter Bruckner. Peter is a medical doctor and specialist sports and exercise medicine physician. He is a founding partner of the Olympic Park Sports Medicine Centre in Melbourne, a two-time president of the Australian College of Sports Physicians, which he helped develop from the ground up, and has been team doctor to many amateur and professional sporting teams, including Melbourne and Collingwood AFL teams, National Olympians, the Australian Cricket Club, the Socceroos, as well as Liverpool Football Club in the EPL. Peter has more recently also discovered a passion in nutrition and is the founder and chair of the Sugar by Half campaign. Peter was generous enough to sit down with me for an interview about his experiences, challenges, and interests throughout his life and career. There were definitely moments that were unexpected hidden gems and tangents that I think are going to be really interesting for everyone and make this a particularly insightful conversation for me. I would also like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land in which we reside, here in what is now known as Australia, the place of recording. I extend my respects to elders of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, past, present and emerging. AMSA acknowledges that sovereignty of this land has never been ceded, and this land always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
I'm only human, can you see? I made a mistake. Please just look me in my face. Tell me everything's okay. Cause I got it. Ooh, never be like you.
So without further ado, welcome Peter.
Thanks, Melinda. Pleasure to be here.
Lovely. Can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Oh, okay. My name's Peter Bruckner. I'm 67 years old. I was born in Melbourne and went to school and university in Melbourne. My passion, I guess, as a kid and continues to this day has always been sport. You know, I was one of these kids who sort of, if I wasn't playing sport, I was watching sport or reading about sport, and that was sort of my main interest, I guess, in life. You know, you'd sort of read the back page of the paper before you read the front page.
Yeah.
In fact, I thought it'd be a good sign that I'd eventually grown up when I started reading the front page first, but hasn't happened yet. So we'll keep working on that.
Perhaps in the next few years then.
Yeah, you got to have a quick look at the front page, because if it's a really big sports story, especially if it's the Herald Sun, it'll be on the front page of the paper. So there you go.
So still a big sports enthusiast.
Yeah, I still love that. That's probably my major sort of interest. And, yeah, I was at school. I really wanted to be a sports reporter, really, or a sports journalist. But my mother convinced me that probably wasn't the most reliable profession in the world and convinced me to do medicine. So I did medicine at Melbourne Uni. Wasn't a particularly good student. Got far too involved in sort of sport at university, you know, playing footy and running the football club and so on, which I'm still involved with now 50 years later. Back in those days, it was very much a 3 years of sort of science and 3 years of clinical work. And I didn't enjoy the first 3 years at all, and then started to enjoy it more as I got into the hospitals and actually saw some patients. So finished up graduating, then worked here for a couple of years, went off to England for 3 years to practice on the Poms, as we used to call it. Spent most of that time, you know, either working or watching sport. If you're a sports lover, London is a great place to be. So there was a massive amount of sport to be watched. So I enjoyed doing that and worked various jobs there. Came back here. I'd always sort of, you know, thought that maybe sports medicine would be an opportunity. But in those days, it really didn't exist, to be honest. I mean, there was a few doctors who were sort of helping out with football teams, but there was no sort of a career path or profession or no one really doing full-time sports medicine. Mm-hmm. This is back in the early 1980s. And so I came back and sort of went into general practice with an interest, if you like, in sports medicine. And the sports medicine side of it gradually grew, and I started getting involved in the sports medicine community. And then the opportunity came to open a new sports medicine clinic at the Olympic Park complex in Melbourne. And I sort of thought, oh, well, I'll take the plunge and go full-time into sports medicine I'll give it 6 months and see how it goes. And, that was, 40-odd years ago, and it's the 6 months has extended a fair bit. And then started getting involved with teams, and I did a lot of volunteering initially. Go along to football matches or athletics meets or swimming carnivals or whatever, and just be the volunteer doctor. And that actually got me my first gig overseas, because of my involvement with university football at Melbourne Uni. They they got to know me a bit, and they invited me to be the team doctor for the Australian universities team going to the World Student Games.
Yeah,
they'd never taken a doctor before, and so I got that gig. Mm-hmm. That was in Edmonton, Canada.
Yeah.
And I was all, you know, terribly excited. And then they told me that I had to pay my own way. And I had to take, you know, take a month off work and pay my own fares. And they thought, oh, okay. Welcome to sports medicine.
Were you practicing as a GP at that time?
Yeah, I was a GP at the, at the time. Yeah. And, and I thought, no, I need to do this. You know, we just got married, come back from England. We had no money. You know, it was just the wrong thing to do completely. But I just sort of felt I just had to take that opportunity. And it turned out really well because you get to meet people through there and you get up, get invited to do other things and so on. So I finished up doing three World Student Games in where were they? Edmonton and Kobe, Japan and Zagreb in what was then Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I sort of got invited to get involved in swimming and I did the Australian swim team for a few years. And then one of my passions has always been athletics. So I got involved with athletics as well and did sort of a 10-year stint with the athletics team. And then at the same time, we started up this clinic at Olympic Park in Melbourne, which was quickly sort of grew to be a large sort of multidisciplinary clinic. So we had both sports doctors and orthopedic surgeons there. We had physios, podiatrists, nutritionists, psychologists, massage therapists, and so on. So it was really truly a multidisciplinary clinic, and I think that's still was and still is the largest sports medicine centre in the country. Mm-hmm. Then probably the interesting thing that happened around that time was I got a letter.
Okay.
And you know, you probably don't know what a letter is, but it's sort of thing, the way we used to communicate years and years ago. And this letter arrived, and it invited me to a meeting in Sydney to discuss establishing a specialty of sports medicine. In those days, you know, it was quite a big deal to go to Sydney. You know, this is sort of 40 years ago. You know, it wasn't sort of, you didn't just jump on a plane without thinking about it. And again, had no money and thought, oh, I shouldn't do this, but I thought, no, I need to go to this meeting. So I went to this meeting, there was 30-odd people there, and I was just sitting there listening, and they said, oh, we're going to form a college.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, college? You can't just form a college. You know, the Royal Colleges have been in existence for, you know, 200 years, and you can't just form a college.
Yeah.
But they did, and I became part of that that college right from the start. That was the Australian College of Sports Physicians, and later became the Australasian College, and later became the Australasian College of Sport and Exercise Medicine Physicians. So, that was really the start of my involvement in sort of the world of sports medicine, I guess. And I became very involved and very passionate about that cause, about establishing a specialty. So you can imagine you're literally starting from scratch. So there's no qualification, there's no training program, there's no exams, there's no curriculum, there's nothing.
Yeah.
So we had a blank sheet and we had a group of about half a dozen of us who put an incredible amount of work in over 10 years probably to establish a college from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, initially the curriculum. We invited everyone who was doing sports medicine in the country to put their CVs in and be assessed. And we invited a few. We didn't give any grandfather sort of fellowships. We all had to do the first exam. So myself included. And I was 40 of us who did the first exam. And we did the exam 1 year and we were examiners the next year, which was a meteoric rise. But anyway, so that got started. And then we started a training program again. You know, the only training program in the country that had no government funding because it was non-hospital based, and we funded it ourselves basically, our own time and things. So there was some huge challenges in getting that established. But you know, when we started, they said, "Oh, it'll take you 15 years to get you know, become a specialty," and we said, "Oh, no, it won't. You know, you haven't seen us in action." Well, sure enough, 18 years later, we became a specialty, and
very impressive.
You know, it was a long, hard haul. Memories of stalking the corridors of Parliament House in Canberra, waiting to talk to politicians and talking to the other colleges and it was huge.
Would have been quite an intensive process.
It was very interesting, but incredibly frustrating.
Yes, I can imagine.
Yeah.
Did you base the program off a certain structure? Like, did you follow like an international program, or was it completely built from the ground up?
Yeah, look, we realised that we had to sort of stick to the formula of the other colleges, basically. So we modelled ourselves on the other colleges, you know, part one exam, part two exams, training programs, et cetera, et cetera. So, you had to sort of, you know, because obviously if you're going to be accepted as a specialty, you had to sort of tick all those boxes and so on. So we did all that. At one stage, the health minister decided to just cancel the whole specialisation process. So we were about 3 years there where there was no process at all. So that was pretty frustrating. Yeah. But anyway, I won't bore you with all the details, but we got there in the end. And so we established really, a specialty from scratch, which was never really been
done
before.
That's very impressive.
And, so now we have fellows of the college. We've nearly got 200 now, and we have another sort of 60 or 70 registrars going through the process and so on. So that's a big part of my mm-hmm. life for a long time.
Yeah.
And that was good, and then just continued on in the running the clinic, and then getting more and more involved in teams. As I said, I did the national athletics team for 10 years, so that involved world championships, Olympic games. My first Olympic games was in Atlanta in 1996. Yep. I went as the athletics team doctor, and just before the games, the assistant manager pulled out, so they gave me that job as well. Mm-hmm. So I had a dual role yep. there. And then for Sydney, they asked me if I'd be the manager of the athletics team. So I didn't actually do anything medical there. We had another doctor who was actually a bit of a colleague of mine.
Yeah.
And I was the manager of the team. So I was responsible for, 80-odd athletes and 40 staff. And that was a massive job for in the preceding couple of years, all the planning and everything. But that was pretty exciting. Sydney was an amazing Olympics, incredibly great atmosphere, very successful Olympics, made Australians, I think, feel very proud of our country, the way mm-hmm. we pulled it off. But it was full on for me. Mm-hmm. That's a huge job. But no, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
And so on. And,
so you worked with Kathy Freeman, is it, when she achieved her gold medal? Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. How was that? That's an inspiring story many Australians, such as me, grew up hearing about and watched on the telly. And it was pretty amazing to be there on the front line, per se, and ensuring that all the athletes were at peak physical condition so that they could achieve such amazing goals such as that.
Yeah, it was a pretty special occasion. Obviously, I'd known Kathy for some years. We'd been away on teams and so on. And the lead up to the Olympics, was incredible. I mean, it was all about Kathy. I mean, it was, she was the biggest star of the Games. She was our only genuine gold medal chance in the biggest sport of the Games, athletics. So there was a massive mm-hmm. build-up, and everyone was, and tickets for, the night that she was in the final was came to be known as Freeman night, and you couldn't get a ticket for Freeman night. I mean, it was so hard to get it.
Yeah.
Everyone was having sort of Freeman parties and barbecues all around the country and so on.
Yeah.
And the pressure she was under was just unbelievable. I mean, I don't think I'm a bit of a Olympic historian, and I don't think anyone in the history of the Olympics had been under as much pressure as Kathy Freeman.
Mm.
I mean, it was just incredible. And then in case there was anyone in the country who didn't realise that she was the star, they got her to light the flame at the opening ceremony as well.
Yeah.
So that was it was just huge. And I don't think there are too many other people who would have coped. She had this amazing ability to just tune out, and she would just go into her little world and tune out what all the crazy madness that was happening around her.
Mm-hmm.
And people thought she was, I think a bit sort of standoffish but in fact, I think that was just her way of coping.
Yeah.
And she coped incredibly well. And so she came out and on the night and won the race, in that amazing suit that she was the only person to wear, and it was unique to her. And and the funny thing was when she crossed the line and she won, and most people when they win an Olympic gold medal, in like Usain Bolt, they sort of carry on like idiots and sort of jump around prance around and do their little celebrations and so on. Well, Kathy didn't. She just sat down on the track and had her head in her hands. And I remember thinking, I was just standing just the finishing line, I'm saying, oh, come on, Kathy, get up, come on, get moving. And it seemed like she sat there forever. It was probably only 30 seconds or a minute or something like that. I don't know. But it was incredible. And then she sort of slowly got up and did her sort of lap of honour. And one of my jobs as the team manager was to sort of basically look after the athletes from the time mm-hmm. they sort of came off the track, take them through media, there was like a media throng there. They'd do interviews and then up to get interviewed by Bruce McAvoney up in the Channel 7 box. And then we went to, see her family and then down in drug testing and so on. So I was basically looking after her for the 3 or 4 hours after the mm-hmm. after the event. And, it was a pretty surreal experience. And I remember we were sitting down there and waiting for her drug test. And I remember thinking to we were just chatting about, where we're going on holiday or something like that. And I remember thinking to myself, the whole country is going crazy about this girl sitting next to me and celebrating and everything. And here am I just sitting down here talking to her about her holiday. It was just a bizarre feeling, really. And pretty amazing. But mm-hmm. And then, you know, sort of took her through the victory ceremony and so on. And
yeah,
there's a bit of a story to the victory ceremony, actually, because 4 years previously in Atlanta,
mm-hmm.
She'd come second in the 400 metres, and terrific run. She actually ran faster then than she did in Sydney. And
okay.
But she was, you know, which was a great result for her, because the girl who won it, Marie-Jose Parekh, was clearly the best in the world, and everyone was, you know, really hoping Cathy would win a medal. And we thought she would, but anyway, so she came second. And again, I was looking after them, her after the event, and, you know, we were going through the media and doing all that sort of stuff. And then they came and said to her, okay, Cathy, it's time to time for the victory, to get ready for the victory ceremony. You know, there's a room down here. You can come down and powder your nose and do your hair and all that sort of stuff. And
yeah.
And so I said to Cathy, I said, okay, you know, Cathy, you know, look, get your tracksuit on and we'll get going. As you know, you receive your gold medal or your medals in your tracksuit, your team tracksuit, not in your, you know, running gear.
Mm-hmm.
So Cathy, I said, you know, come on, Cathy, let's go. And she looked up to me, you know, with those big brown eyes of her, and said, "Doc," I said, "What do you mean? What's up, Cathy?" She said, "Oh, I haven't got my tracksuit with me." I said, "Oh, good joke, Cathy. You know, there's no time for jokes now, Cathy. Come on, let's get on with it." I said, "No, no, no, I haven't got it. I didn't think I'd win a medal." Oh, my God. Anyway, so my sort of whole sports medicine career flashed in front of me, really. I had 10 minutes to get Cathy Freeman a tracksuit and get her onto the – because they had a strict rule, no tracksuit, no medal ceremony.
Okay,
so I had this vision that the whole country was sort of waiting up at night to watch Cathy get her medal, you know, and she's going to walk out and there's a gold medalist and a bronze medalist and there's no silver medalist.
Mm.
So I said to Cathy, stay there. Problem was, it was about 38 degrees in Atlanta and 100% humidity, and no one had their tracksuits with them.
Mm.
So I ran upstairs to where all the Australians were sitting in a big group, and sort of, so I yelled out across a whole bunch of people. I said, anyone got a tracksuit? You know, Cathy needs a tracksuit. And one of the girls sort of one of the girls had a tracksuit top, so she, you know, said, "Yeah, you know, threw me this top." Still had no tracksuit pants.
Yeah.
And anyway, so I spied a lady there, Debbie Flintoff King, who'd won the gold medal in 1988 in Seoul, and she was there as a spectator, and
mm-hmm.
she had her tracksuit pants on.
Yeah.
And so I yelled out across all these Americans, you know, saying, "Deb, Deb, you know, what have you got under your tracksuit pants?" And she yelled out, "Oh, just my knickers." And I said, you know, Cathy needs them. Cathy needs them. And so she understood the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's whipped her tracksuit pants off and thrown them over to me. I've run down to Cathy and given her Debbie Flintoff King's tracksuit pants and another girl's tracksuit top.
Yeah.
And she's walked out the victory ceremony and no one was any the wiser.
That's quite a funny story.
Until they get to play the French national anthem, you know, and everyone has to stand up. And Debbie Flintoff King has to stand up in her knickers. But anyway, she's forgiven me for it. And Cathy and I, we actually caught up recently and had a bit of a laugh about that at the time. But so then became a standard thing that she would never bring a tracksuit because it was a good luck thing.
Wow!
And so one of our jobs was always to bring a spare tracksuit to Cathy. So in Sydney, I had the spare tracksuit in my bag, and I said, "Here it is." And we had a bit of a laugh about that, and. Out she went to out she went to get her medal. So, yeah, you know, you're very privileged in those situations as a doctor or as a, you know, team member, and you know, to really be part of
yeah.
history. I mean, it was voted Australia's greatest ever sporting moment, and you know, you're sort of there as a part of it. So yeah, you feel very special.
How did you manage working under such pressure and scrutiny, working in such a public sphere of medicine, like being involved with such like iconic moments such as this?
Yeah, look, you are under a bit of scrutiny, certainly. You know, in all the sports, I mean, everyone's an expert and everything you do is scrutinized. And you know, doctors cop a bit of criticism sometimes for the way they manage, you know, especially things like concussion, which is a really difficult thing to manage. Look, it's just part of the deal. You know, there are some good things and bad things about being involved in sport.
Yeah.
And certainly, the scrutiny is one of them. But you know, look, there's lots of good things about it too. You know, you've got a job that someone's paying you to watch sport, you know? I mean, what's better than that? You know?
Yeah, as a boy growing up interested in sport, I couldn't think of a better career for sure.
Exactly, exactly. You know, that was sort of, you know, what everything I'd ever dreamed of. Well, I No, to be fair, I'd actually dreamed of playing, you know, myself, you know, playing cricket for Australia or, you know, football for in the AFL or whatever. But I got to about the age of 16 and realised, no, that's not going to happen. So I came up with a plan B. So that was my plan B.
Yeah, so you still got involved. That's pretty impressive. I'm sure there were still moments of great pressure, though. How did you handle pressure? Because I know in a medical career in particular, as well as in medical school, there are immense pressures involved. How did you cope with all the pressures?
Yeah, look, I think you just get it, you go about your job. I mean, you know, if you're on the sidelines in a football match and, you know, someone sort of limps off the ground and, you know, if you're in your clinic or in your rooms, you know, you can sort of sit the patient down and take a history and then do a thorough examination and then maybe get a, you know, a scan or two and so on and then make your decision then, you know. But on the sidelines, you know, in a sporting match, you know, you've got about 30 seconds to decide. Yeah. The coach is screaming down through the headphones saying, get him back on. And you're trying to assess someone under that sort of that sort of pressure. And that, you know, that. I mean, I'm not saying that's anything as bad as the pressure of you know, real medicine, but it's got its own pressures with it. And I don't know. I just think you've got to remain calm and just, you know, sort of shut out all the external nonsense that's going on and just make your clinical decision. And you know, I think the big challenge too in sports medicine is to not become a fan. You know, not sort of be affected by, you know, oh, that might be your best player and you've got to get him back out there or anything like that. You've got to and also that you're there primarily for the patient. You're not there for the team or for the sport or anything like that. I mean, yeah, sure, you want, you know, the team to do well, but ultimately your responsibility is to your patient, who is that athlete.
Very much so.
And you've got to, you know, assess that athlete. And if he can go back on, great. But if he can't, well, you know, that's too bad for the team. And you've got to stick by your decision. And yeah, look, I certainly had a couple of run-ins with coaches who, you know, didn't think that, you know, I should have taken someone off or ruled them out from the next game and so on. I mean, again, concussion was always a challenging one. And I remember I was at Melbourne and I ruled out probably our best player from a game the following week, and the coach wasn't at all happy, you know. And
can imagine.
Ultimately, he said, "Well, what would you do if I played him?" I said, "Well, you know, you'll find out. He'll have a new doctor next week." And I won that one. But look, they're difficult, and as we all know in medicine, I mean, you know, if you're not in medicine, you sort of think medicine is black and white, you know, that everything is sort of, they're right or they're not right. But, you know, there's a lot of grey, and the same in sports medicine. You know, very few people go onto an AFL field or an NRL field on a Saturday 100% fit.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're always carrying something, a niggle or an injury of some sort. And the challenge, the science and some of the art of medicine is actually determining, you know, whether that player is right to play or not. And, and that can depend on a whole lot of factors, maybe the mental state of the individual player as well as the state of their actual injury. So, plenty of challenges, but, you know, no more so than any other branch of medicine. You know, I think every part of medicine has its challenges, and that was just one of ours.
Yeah. It probably also helps that you had a bunch of good colleagues and good friends who you're working alongside who helped formulate this whole college and this whole career. And as a sports physician, you do work alongside many other healthcare workers, including physios, etc. Why do you think being a team worker in particular is so important, and not just as a sports physician, but as a medical professional altogether?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think sports medicine is almost the ultimate multidisciplinary model because, you know, we really, I mean, I think to be fair, a lot of medicine pays, you know, pretends that they're multidisciplinary, but really it's very hierarchical.
Yeah.
The doctor is, you know, the god, and everyone else is sort of, you know, somewhere down below. But in sports medicine, I mean, I learned most of my sports medicine from physios.
Yeah.
You know, the physios are much better trained than we are at musculoskeletal examination and rehab and so on. So I learned, and in fact, I tell young, you know, the young doctors who come and work with me for their first sort of gig, and I say, well, you know, if they're looking after a football team, I say, well, look, you know, you've got three jobs. And I say, oh, what's that? And I said, okay, well, you've got to look after the concussions. I say, okay. And then you've got to look after any suturing or serious injuries. I say, oh, yeah, okay. And then they say, what's the third job? And I say, the rest of the time, you just follow the physio around and listen to everything they say and learn from them. And the ones that go on and do well are the ones who are prepared to, you know, learn from the physios. The ones who think that they're too good to learn anything from physios, they finish up as orthopedic surgeons.
Yeah.
So but you know, it's a really, it's very much a team approach. No, you know, no one has all the answers, yeah. And we work very closely together. And I really enjoy that. I mean, I love a team environment, and both at our clinic and with teams. You know, one of the most enjoyable aspects is working with other professionals. And you know, I've been lucky. I've worked with some outstanding physiotherapists, mm-hmm. And who are just so knowledgeable, and also sports scientists and nutritionists and psychologists. I mean, I've been very lucky and learned a lot. And I think, you know, we've given you give the best care to the athlete, which is what it's all about. If you have a multidisciplinary approach, so. I really like that aspect of sports medicine, to be honest.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. There are many individuals involved in ensuring that someone is healthy and fit to play in such an intensive sport. Very much understand that. Can you tell us a bit about your experience working with the Liverpool Football Club?
Yeah, well, that was that was something that just came out of the blue,
yeah,
really.
Okay.
I was working with the Socceroos, yeah. As the Socceroos doctor, the Australian national team, mm-hmm. And just got a phone call for one day, and they. I said, "Oh, would you be interested in working in the Premier League?" And and I sort of said, "Oh, because there was something I'd sort of thought, oh, that'd be nice to do." You know, when we had four kids and they were sort of, you know, getting going through teenage years, and I was, you know, my wife and I had sort of said, "Oh, maybe when the kids are, you know, roll out of school, you know, it'd be nice to go back to England for a, you know, stint and work with the Premier League team." But I was still a couple of years too early for that, really. Mm. So my initial response was, "Oh, look, you know, it's not really the right time."
Yeah.
Our youngest was still at school and, you know, I didn't really want to do that. And but I sort of said, oh, you know, by the way, what team are you talking about? Mm-hmm. And they were a bit cagey. They wouldn't give anything away. And they sort of, so I said, oh, look, you know, give me some hits. You know,
yeah.
Just have a play this little game. And they said, it's a team in the Northwest. So for those who don't know England, that basically means Liverpool or Manchester.
Yeah.
So. There's two teams in Liverpool and Liverpool and Everton. There are two teams in Manchester, Man City, Man United. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of obviously one of those four teams. So I said, okay. So I said red or blue. And Liverpool and Man United, red, and Everton and Manchester, blue.
Yeah.
And they said red. They said red. So I thought, oh, this is Liverpool or Man United, probably the two biggest teams of the last, 50 years.
So
I started to think, oh, yeah, this might be interesting. Anyway, so – they didn't really take no for an answer. They were very persistent, mm-hmm. And they kept trying to convince me to go, and took me over for an interview, and I had an interview, and that went really well, and they offered me the job, and so I spoke to the family, and we sort of came to a bit of an arrangement where, you know, my daughter was already working in London,
yeah.
and the other kids had sort of come over for the holidays, and my son who was still at school would come over for holidays, mm-hmm. And the kids were all supportive and so on, and surprisingly enough, they were all pretty keen sports nuts.
Yeah.
So I don't know where they got that from. But so I sort of went. So basically, we had the Soccer World Cup in South Africa in 2010,
yeah.
And the day after Australia were eliminated, I was on a plane to Liverpool, and Liverpool was in a state of a fair bit of disarray at that time.
Okay.
They were trying to sort of change owners. They were changing CEOs. They were changing managers. It was a crazy mm-hmm. time. And walked into this club, you know, that this iconic sort of club with huge support all over the world. And it was a shambles.
Yeah.
It was an absolute shambles. There was no one there. They didn't have a manager. They didn't have any staff. Mm-hmm. It was quite incredible. So it was an interesting start. And I really enjoyed my time there. I mean. It's an amazing, amazing club. It's an amazing city. I was a bit hesitant about the city of Liverpool because previously when I'd been in England, Liverpool was a bit of a sort of a dump and they had riots and, you know, all that sort of stuff back in the 80s. But Liverpool was a lovely city. I really, really mm-hmm. enjoyed it. I guess any city whose two passions are music and football can't be such a
very
bad place.
So.
And turned out to be a great place. And as an old Beatles fan, I enjoyed that a bit. But it was a great experience, very challenging, very different. You know, the Premier League world, there's just so much money and it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the players have a lot of power and the managers are, you know, they're a weird bunch. They're a very interesting group to work with. So because, you know, they don't have a lot of job security and they're usually, you know, out of a job if they lose a couple of games and so on. So it was a very interesting world. But I brought a couple of Australians with me, guys I'd worked with at the Socceroos.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that was great. And then we got a really good crew together, doctors and physios and fitness staff and so on. And I think we had a bit of an impact on there. I think we always sort of assume that, you know, anything in the like the English Premier League or the NBA in America or anything like that must be sort of bigger and better and more wonderful. But I don't think their medical and fitness and sports science was any better than AFL. Okay. In fact, you know, it probably wasn't as good as the AFL and NRL. So, you know, we instituted a lot of things there and had a great time. So, no, really, it was a great experience. And again, you know, you as with the Cathy Freeman's this world, you get to work with you know some amazing athletes. You know, Steven Gerrard and Fernando Torres and Luis Suarez and so on. And just being able to watch them train, I mean, you would pay, you know, people would pay a fortune, I reckon, just to sit down on the sidelines and watch these guys train every day. And we could do that. You know, it was just if you love sort of sport and appreciate amazing athletes, then it's a great opportunity. And also just to get to know them. But what you realize when you're working with these people is that they're just normal people. You know, they just happen to have an incredible skill and be paid ridiculous amounts of money, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds a week, not a year. You know, but underneath it all, I mean, they've got the same issues as everyone else. They've got the same family issues, relationship issues, you know, all those sort of issues that, that we all have. And they're no different. And you've got to treat them. You know, they're real people with real issues. And, you know, you can't sort of get sort of seduced by the fact that, you know, they're household names and so on. But by and large, they're good people. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Steven Gerrard, for instance, you know, so it's just a lovely guy and just a really good person who very down to earth and grounded and so on. Luis Suarez was an interesting one. I mean, probably the most competitive person I've ever met in my life. You know, he's famous for having bitten a few players in his time as a player. But
did you have to deal with any of those injuries?
No. Fortunately, he didn't do any biting when he was at Liverpool. But it was before and after. But you know, we when we signed him, he was actually under suspension from a biting incident. And we thought, gosh, this guy's, you know, we were sort of a bit hesitant to, you know, to meet this guy. We thought, oh God, you know, he's going to be this animal sort of a guy. And he was the nicest, quietest, gentlest, friendliest person you could meet. Just a really lovely person, very devoted to his family. Didn't drink, didn't smoke, and yet as soon as he crossed that white line, whether it was a training or at a game, he became a different person and incredibly competitive. Even at training, I mean, he would kick the crap out of, you know, his teammates and so on. And if they complained, he'd just say, well, you know, we got to play and train like we play. And you just had to admire his intensity and so on. He was incredible. So, just, again, you know, just great to see both sides of Luis Suarez and so on. So, yeah, lots of great memories from Liverpool. Still keep in touch with people there and get back there whenever I can. And just the stadium and the atmosphere and the fans, it's just quite incredible. I mean, anyone who gets the opportunity to go to a football match at Anfield, I mean, when they start singing "You'll Never Walk Alone," it just still sends shivers down my spine. Yeah. You know, and I've been going there for 10 years now, so it's a great. And you really, I mean, we think we're passionate about our footy in Australia, but to these people, I mean, it's
above
just
and beyond.
Absolutely. Their whole lives revolve around the football club, and the hatred they have for other, you know, like the hatred they have for Man United is. You cannot wear a Manchester United shirt in Liverpool. Honestly, it's quite incredible. And I've never experienced, you know, we thought that, you know, there are rivalries here, but nothing like it is over there. So that was a great experience.
Yeah. Prior to entering the EPL, did you have a team that you preference, or are you just going to say Liverpool all the way?
No. Well, to be honest, I did. Yeah. I was a Tottenham fan.
Okay.
I'd always been a Tottenham fan from when I was a kid. Yeah. And then I lived in London for 3 years and followed them a lot. Yeah. And we'd won a couple of cup finals. Yeah. But the funny thing was the night of my interview, Liverpool played Tottenham at Liverpool.
Okay. Yeah.
And I was sitting up there in the director's box, torn between the two because it was important. By that stage, I sort of figured I was going to, you know, do the job. And And Liverpool needed to win to get into the Champions League, I think, for the next year and so on. And so I reckon it took me about a half to change my allegiance. By the end of it, I was a Liverpool man, despite a lifetime of a fanatical Tottenham support. And now I'm still a Liverpool fan. I get up in ridiculous hours of the night to watch games and
to watch the games.
Watching them. Unfortunately, they weren't too good when I was there, and in fact, they seem to have got better ever since I left.
I'm sure there's no correlation.
No, absolutely not. We set it up for them. Set it up.
Exactly.
Bad experience.
Yeah. Upon your departure, Liverpool weren't doing so well, but they were the highest ranked regarding how healthy and fit the players were, with the fewest injuries. So I definitely agree you had a real impact there.
But I don't know about that. But anyway, it was good.
How did you find working in a different healthcare system? So working primarily in a Melbourne-based and the healthcare system we have here compared to going to London, etc., and having the different healthcare system there. Were there any difficulties, or how did you find the transition?
Yeah, look, not really. I mean, I guess, when you're working at a football club, you're a little bit, isolated from the health system, from the NHS. I mean, I had a little bits to do with the NHS. I mean, primarily because we did all our scans at the Liverpool General Hospital, and so I spent a bit of time there. Look, I think, but I'd previously worked, years ago in the NHS in England, and it was That's certainly a different. A different system. Unfortunately, like most of medicine, it's chronically underfunded these days. But it's like most things, if you're really sick, they probably look after you pretty well. If you're not so sick, it's not such a great system. It certainly is interesting. In Liverpool, for instance, there was very little private medicine. If you go into London, there's quite a lot of private medicine, but very little in Liverpool. So it was largely NHS. But we certainly had access to very very good specialists and so on through the football club. I think it's a good system. The NHS, as I said, it's just like every country. Medicine is just too expensive for governments to fund it adequately.
That's very true. You were also involved quite heavily in the Australian cricket team.
I was.
You were actually the sports physician. You were the sports physician during Bill Hughes' unfortunate passing. Can you tell us a bit more about this very quite traumatic incident that occurred and how you dealt with it? I saw that you were quite actively involved in the measures and management post. And how did you deal with that situation?
Yeah, well, that's certainly been the most difficult experience of my career. Phil Hughes was a much loved cricketer. He was a particular friend of mine. Yeah. I mean, we when you tour with cricket teams, you always sit in exactly the same spot in the bus.
Okay.
And I was always opposite Phil, and we would always always be chatting. And he was everyone's best friend.
Yeah.
He was just. And we all speak well of the dead and so on, but you could generally say he would have been the most popular cricketer in the country among his peers. He was a lovely man. So, I actually wasn't there when he. I was actually in a meeting in Melbourne, and I came out of this meeting and I had a message from a text message from my son who was in New York, I think at the time, and he said, "Oh, what's happened to Phil Hughes? Sounds bad." And I thought, "What's he talking about?"
Yeah.
So I jumped on Twitter or something like that and found out found the basic details that he'd been struck in the neck and been instantly unconscious and been taken straight to hospital and I thought I've got to I don't know why I thought this but I jumped straight in my car, drove straight to the airport, rang Cricket Australia, said get me on the next flight I literally went straight to Sydney, just in the clothes I was in with nothing went straight to the hospital and John Orchard, who was the New South Wales doctor, old friend of mine, good colleague of mine, had been the doctor on duty that day and he'd had an incredibly stressful, traumatic day, as you can imagine. So he met me at the hospital and filled me in and I sort of said to him, look, you go home and get some sleep and we'll catch up in the morning. So I sort of did the night shift and by that stage he was he was still unconscious and he'd had a couple of surgeries already. Things there was they felt there was still some hope of him pulling through. So I spent the night. So his family were around there, and Michael Clark, the Australian captain, was there as well. And I spent the night sort of sitting half sleeping in the ICU waiting room, and getting updates and chatting to the family and so on. Yeah. And so it sort of, I guess it soon became obvious that it was the sort of the doctor's role really to sort of run the process. You know, I mean, obviously that he was being looked after by, you know, by excellent people in ICU, but for everything else, people seemed to sort of turn to the doctor to, you know, for information and for anything like that. So I really spent the next day or two, you know, talking to all the to the Cricket Australia people, the other players, and to the family, and trying to be the sort of link between the family and the specialists and so on. And unfortunately, by sort of midway through the next day, it was clear. Well, the team at St Vincent's came to us and said, "Look, you know, he's not going to make it, and you know, we're not going to sort of switch off his life support until you're ready." But you know. So that was, you know, that was incredibly traumatic. And then, so by this stage, all the players were starting to come to Sydney and you know, find out what was going on. And one of my jobs was to arrange for the players to come and see Phil, you know, say their, pay their, you know, respects. And so that was incredibly, you know, stressful for the player. I mean, most of them had, you know, never seen anyone dying, let alone, you know, one of their mates. And so they'd come up two at a time, and I'd take them in, and you know, some of them just couldn't, you know, had to go straight out again, and others stayed for a while. And but that was a really important process for the guys to go through. Yeah. I remember having that next night, there was a phone hookup with the board of Cricket Australia, and they really had no idea what was going on at this stage. And, and they said, "Oh, Doc, can you give us an update on Philip Hughes?" And I said, "Well, look, guys, I'm sorry, but you know, I've got some bad news. He's not going to make it."
Yeah.
And there was just this, you could feel this sort of shocked silence at the end of the phone, and no one said anything. You know, it was just, you know, you're not supposed to die playing cricket. I mean, it's just, you know, it doesn't happen. I mean, you get a whack on the head, and you know, you might have a few stitches or a bit of concussion.
Exactly.
You know, you don't die. And then I had a phone hookup with these South Australian teammates because they'd all gone home because they'd abandoned the game and so on. And again, I don't think they had any idea that it was as bad as it was. You know, and. And I got up and I said, "Look, guys, you know, he's going to die."
Yeah.
And, you know, for those young men, I mean, it was just, you know, what do you say? What do you say to them? I mean, it's really, really difficult. So lots of very difficult conversations and really difficult time and so on. And then, of course, you know, there was massive media coverage. You know, the whole country seemed to be sort of involved in it. And so they asked me to sort of give these regular media reports and so on. So, and then when they finally sort of switched off his life support and so on, and I sort of said, "Look, I think we really need to have a, you know, have a press conference and explain what's going on," because everyone was, you know, it's a lot of confusion. You know, as I said, you're not supposed to die, and so there was a number of things that I wanted to say at the press conference. So firstly, I wanted to say, you know, that what a great job, you know, that St Vincent's had done, and the ambulance and everyone like that, and thank everyone and so on. And also what an amazing job that Michael Clark had done, and you know, he was fantastic and so on, the way he'd supported the family and so on. But I really wanted to sort of get the message out there that this was a freakish incident, that it's not going to happen to your brother, son, father on Saturday when they play cricket at their local club.
Yeah.
Explain a little bit about what had happened and and how rare it is and how unlikely it's ever, you know, it's ever going to happen. Try and reassure everyone that, you know, cricket wasn't a dangerous dangerous sport. So, yeah, so that was really, really difficult trying to hold it together in that press conference with, you know, there was must have been 100 press there from all around the world and so on. And that was tough, but I felt that was a really important message to get to. And then after that, we all sort of adjourned to the SCG, you know, as cricketers do, for a bit of a wake in the bar at the SCG, and some of the players went out to the, you know, to the pitch where he was hit, and, you know, sort of paid homage there. And I remember one of the players coming up to me and said, "Doc, you've got to keep telling us this is a freakish accident. It's not going to happen to us. Otherwise, we can't keep going." And I thought, "Ooh, you know, this was like a very senior player who, you know, I thought would be, so really, really tough times. And again, we had a mm-hmm. team meeting the next day and I explained again to the players what had happened. Again, tried to sort of reassure them then we had the funeral, which was nationally televised. It was a massive event and really incredibly difficult times and so on. And then we had to go and play cricket the next week. Yeah. We literally flew straight from the funeral to Adelaide to play a test match against India. And we flew there, and I remember the first day's training. The guys just couldn't do it. I mean, some of them would just walk into bat and just walk out two balls later, and I remember thinking then, God, we've got to play a test match in 3 days' time. There's no way we're going to be able to play a test match. But, the guys sort of got it together and sort of did a bit of reasonable practice. And then we turn up to this test match in Adelaide. And the start of the test match, there's everywhere you go, it's Phil Hughes. It's 408, which his test number was printed on the turf. Yep. And there were signs up everywhere. And there was this emotional Richie Beno tribute before the game. And as the players lined up. And all our players are in tears.
Mm.
And again, two minutes after this lineup, they're going to go out and face India's fast bowlers. And I'm thinking, oh my God, there's no way we're going to.
Yeah.
Anyway, we did get through that. And the thing I always sort of point to is that the three players who were closest to Philip Hughes were the three players who scored centuries in that first innings. And
they were playing David for
Warner,
Phil.
Yeah, David Warner, Steve Smith, and Michael Clarke. There was no way Michael Clarke wasn't going to score a century that day. He was just absolutely going to do it for his buddy. So, that was a really stressful, very difficult time. And the whole summer was difficult. And we dedicated the World Cup at the end of the summer to Philip. And fortunately, we were able to win that. And, that sort of brightened everyone up a bit. But it's still, I still think about it a lot. Still think about him and all the players do. I know it still affects them enormously, but that was, that's something you can't prepare for and hope you never have to go through again.
For sure. It really does highlight the tough reality of sports and how the necessity for doctors to actually be involved and the importance of understanding and avoiding fear-mongering in such a sport like this. Another thing you briefly touched on was mental health. I understand a lot of the players were really struggling emotionally and mentally through this. Mental health would be another important component for well-being of these players. How were you involved in the mental health aspect?
Yeah, well, mental health's a massive issue in all young people, So it would be very naive to think that that athletes would be different. And elite sport has its own pressures on top of everything else that's going on in life. As you mentioned before, incredible scrutiny of everything that they do. And criticism when they fail, and it's not as if they're not trying, but they could, especially in cricket. I mean, especially cricket batsmen. I mean, there's a good reason why there are more suicides among cricket batsmen than any other sport in the world. And it's a shocking thing, I mean, you only get one chance. You walk all the way out the middle there. You get a shocking umpire decision. You're out for a duck, and you walk back out again. It's really tough, and there's a very fine line between success and failure. And you don't get another chance. Footballers will 2 minutes later they'll get another chance to kick a goal if they miss one or something like that. But cricketers, they don't get another chance. They may never get another chance. And it's a really tough environment. And you're traveling a lot. You're away from home. You're away from your support group much more than any other sport, really. I was on the road 1 year, I think 300 nights of the year I was on the road, So it really is a big, a lot of travel, even here in Australia. You're not at home. You're away. So mental health is a massive issue among all young people and particularly and certainly among young athletes. And again, it's just a matter of being there, being as supportive as you can, trying to create the right environment, being a good listener, trying to be alert to signs and always having an open door, people can just, come and chat anytime they want to, and we can talk nonsense or we can talk about the way they're feeling or whatever. Yep. I mean, and that's really important. And just, chatting to people at mealtime and just, finding out about people and their lives and their home lives and so on, because that can be a pretty brutal environment. Yep. And, there's this thing, you're not supposed to show any emotion and you're not supposed to show any sign of weakness and so on. And so people bottle things up and that can be really challenging. So fortunately, you know, we often have psychologists on tour with us, and you know, one of the Michael Lloyd, who was the cricket team psychologist, did a fantastic job. Mm-hmm. But you know, as a doctor, you're looking after the whole person.
Yeah.
You know, you're their GP for their coughs and colds. You're their their mental health person. You're their sports doctor. Yeah. You're their friend. You know, you're their someone to talk to. You know, it's especially on these long tours. You know, we would go on 3-month tours of England, you know, and that can be, you know, everyone say, oh, wow, an Ashes tour, isn't that glamorous and fantastic? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great, but, you know, it's got its challenges as well.
Of course, for sure. It really does highlight the importance of, like, understanding this. So you've also more recently discovered a new interest in nutrition. Can you tell us how this has happened?
I've always had a bit of an interest in nutrition, especially from a sports point of view, I suppose. But to be honest, you know, nutrition had got pretty boring, really, hadn't it? You know, we're all on these low-fat diets and sports drinks and Gatorade and Powerade and, pasta parties the night before, the marathon and all that sort of stuff. That was sports nutrition and nutrition. Yeah. And it all sort of changed for me a few years ago. I just turned 60 and I was living in England. And if you'd asked me then, you know, how was my health? Was I healthy? How are you, doc? You know, I'd say, yeah, I'm good. Yeah, no problems. But the reality was I probably wasn't quite as healthy as I pretended I was. For a start, I had a strong family history of type 2 diabetes. My dad had developed type 2 diabetes at exactly the age I was then, and I was pretty determined not to go down that track because I saw what happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
I was also overweight, borderline obese, you know, like my BMI was sort of 30-odd. I mean, like many sort of middle-aged men you know, I sort of think middle-aged, 60 is middle-aged. I used to think it was old, but now I think it's middle-aged. You know, like many middle-aged men, I'd probably put on 0.5 kilogram a year for 30 years.
Yeah.
Slowly creeping, just getting a little bit tubbier and you know, having to loosen the belt a little bit each year. And to the point where my kids are starting to sort of poke me in the guts and say, you know, come on, Dad, you know, what about it? And I'd also, I wasn't metabolically that healthy. I had a fatty liver. I had high triglycerides, you know. So I really wasn't as healthy as I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And about that time, I started to read and hear a little bit about some people challenging the idea that that fat were the problem, and people suggesting that it was actually carbohydrates that were the problem. And a colleague of mine in South Africa, Tim Noakes, a very famous sports scientist, whose intellect I really admired, he'd developed type 2 diabetes and basically got it under control by changing to a low carb diet.
Yeah,
and I thought, no, that can't be right. That's ridiculous. You know, we're all But it sort of got me started, and I started reading. I read a book called Good Calories, Bad Calories, which was fascinating because it talked not only about whether, you know, carbs or fat were the problem, but it talked about the political history, if you like, of the low-fat versus the low-carb movement and how, for reasons that I always assumed were due to good science but it turned out to be due to money and influence and so on, that the low-fat movement had won out over the low-sugar movement. And the reality was it probably should have been the other way around. So I really started to question everything and started reading everything. And then I thought, well, you know, I'm a scientist. It's time to do some research.
Yeah.
So I decided, but also as a scientist, I knew that research with an N equals one is a waste of time, except when the one happens to be you,
in
which case, you know, it becomes very, very relevant. So I did an N equals one experiment where for 3 months I did my bloods on day one and I went strict sort of low carb, healthy fat diet for 3 months. So I stopped eating soft drinks, fruit juices, sugar, pasta, rice, potatoes, bread, all those sorts of things.
Gone straight cold turkey. Yeah,
I went back to eating the way that probably my parents or grandparents had eaten. You know, lots of fresh fruit and veg, meat, fish, full fat dairy, you know, threw away the margarine, went back to butter, all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the only fruits I had were berries, lots of veg, nuts, seeds, all that sort of stuff. So I did that for 3 months and to cut a long story short, in that 3 months, I lost 13 kilograms in 13 weeks.
Wow.
And I resolved every one of my metabolic issues.
Yeah.
So my fatty liver resolved completely. I'd had a fatty liver for 10 years on my blood tests.
Wow.
Went to completely normal after 13 weeks. My triglycerides went back to normal. My insulin levels went back to normal and so on. So I thought, wow.
It's a life-changing experience.
And I felt fantastic.
Yeah.
Felt great, had energy, stopped snoring, sleeping much better. Mm-hmm. All that sort of stuff, and just blew me away. If you'd told me that would happen a year before, I'd have just said you're mad. But So when that sort of thing happens, I mean, you've really, you know, you almost feel duty bound to spread the word.
Yeah.
So I started becoming a passionate advocate of the low carb, healthy fat sort of lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, one thing led to another. I started giving a whole bunch of talks. And then, you know, was talking to colleagues one day and we were bemoaning the fact that it was so confusing what diet should be on. Everyone had a different diet, you know, paleo and Mediterranean
yeah.
and Atkins and all these sorts of things. And I sort of made the sort of flippant comment that, oh, wouldn't it be great if we could just focus on one thing,
yeah.
you know, and everyone just get on the right thing. And the obvious thing was sugar, because that was the one thing that everyone agreed on was not good for you. So
yeah.
we made this decision to start up our charitable campaign called Sugar by Half. So
okay.
the reason for the half was the aim was to reduce the amount of added sugar from the 16 or so teaspoons that the average Australian was having
yeah.
down to about half of that, which is what the World Health Organization recommended as a maximum dose. So
okay.
so that's a charity has been going for 3 years now, and we've been doing a lot of good stuff, getting things out to schools, corporations, sporting clubs and so on. And, yeah, we've got big plans to develop that. And so then I got approached by a major publisher to ask me if I'd write a book.
Yeah.
And I said, look, really, you know, the last thing the world needs is another diet book. I mean, there's going bloody hundreds of them.
And,
but they said, look, there's very few by doctors mm-hmm. and none by Australian doctors, and that, you know, you would, because of your profile, you'd have some credibility, blah,
yeah.
blah, blah. So I got talked into writing a book, which I did in a really short period of time. I guess I must have had it all sort of in my head, really, and rattle off this book pretty quickly. And
yeah.
It's called A Fat Lot of Good, and it's sold pretty well and still selling quite well. And
that's good to hear.
You know, there's never a week goes by without me getting an email from someone saying, you know, read your book, it's changed my life.
Yeah.
You know, I really want to thank you for it. So, you know, it's... No one ever used to do that when I fixed their ankle, really. So it's nice to nice to get that feedback. And so, that's my major focus now, is really to concentrate on getting people to, you know, we're just getting fatter and sicker mm-hmm. every year, and we keep doing the same thing every year.
Yeah.
We're not changing anything. If you're running a business and your bottom line got worse every single year,
yeah.
wouldn't you at some stage in that sort of 30 or 40 years think, well, maybe we're doing something wrong here?
Yeah.
But no, we just keep giving the same nutrition advice. The same low fat, you know, lots of carbohydrates, and, you know, half the country is going to be diabetic in a few years' time.
Mm-hmm.
So we really got to do something pretty drastic. And along with exercise, which is obviously important as well, but changing our ideas on nutrition. And as you guys would know, I mean, you get so little teaching on nutrition.
Yeah, very true.
In medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think it's really important that people understand that a lot of what we've been telling people the last 30 or 40 years is wrong.
Yeah.
And we need to change our message, and we need to get people to stop sugar, stop refined carbohydrates,
mm-hmm.
stop vegetable oils, and get back to, you know, eating the way that our grandparents used to eat, and get back to, you know, full fat dairy and meat and fish and vegetables, and just stop eating processed food.
Mm-hmm.
And I always say, just avoid the middle aisles of the supermarket.
Yeah.
Know, stick to the outside, and all the good stuff's on the outside. You don't need any of the packaged stuff. So
that's very true.
Yeah, pretty passionate about that
yeah.
These days. And I could go on for another hour or two, but that would bore me.
No, but you've touched on an important topic of the importance that as medical professionals we need to practice what we preach as well. And so we need to look after not just the health of our patients, but also our own health, become educated about exercise and nutrition that would help us to enable this. So in addition to your book, A Fat Lot of Good, I've noticed you've also written the Bible of Sports Medicine, Bruckner and Kahn's Clinical Sports Medicine. So where did this passion for writing stem from?
Probably because I wanted to be a sports journalist now when
yeah.
I was in school. You know, I always used to write the – so I've always quite enjoyed writing and speaking and,
yeah.
and so on. So, again, you know, way back, you know, back – this is, what, 30 years ago now, I got approached by a publisher to write a book on sports medicine. I think
yeah.
they'd read some article I'd written in Australian Doctor or something. You know,
okay.
It's no good reason, really. And,
yeah.
and I felt at the time I was way too – junior, you know, to write a textbook. You know, it's the sort of thing you do when you're, you know, a venerable old expert and so on. But my colleagues reminded me that I'd basically bagged the hell out of every sports medicine book that had been written, because most of them were rubbish.
Yeah.
And they said, well, why don't you, you know,
this is your chance.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I, and again, I just sort of I tried to sort of get something written, and I was just getting nowhere and trying to do it in my spare time. So I thought, oh, I'll take a year off. So
yeah.
I took a year off and wrote this book with a colleague of mine, Karim Khan. And we put this book out, and it just sort of became incredibly popular and successful, and particularly among sports doctors, but also among physios. Mm-hmm. And it was very – because it was very practical. All the other sports medicine books had lots of theory, but none of them actually told you how to manage someone from the history, the examination, the diagnosis, and then the management.
Yeah.
So it was really a sort of a one stop shop how to practice sports medicine really. And it's now in its fifth edition.
Yeah, doing well.
It's gone from being sort of 600 pages and black and white to. So we're now in two volumes. So I think it's 2,000 pages.
Yeah.
I think the first edition probably had about three references every chapter. Now it's got about 300. So it's developed a bit of a life of its own.
Yeah, but, of course.
It's been and obviously we now we wrote most of it ourselves to start with. We now get a lot of help from lots of our colleagues both here and overseas. And it's very much a team effort.
Yeah,
and, it's become. Yeah, it's known as the Bible of sports medicine, and basically it's such a big book. I don't think we've scared off all the opposition. I think so. No one else has written a sports medicine textbook for about the last 10 years, so we've sort of got the market to ourselves. So,
it's a good standard.
We've sold something like 200,000 copies over the years, and it's certainly the biggest selling sports medicine book in Australia, UK, New Zealand, South Africa, et cetera, et cetera. So it's been good for Australian sports medicine because resulted in us getting a lot of recognition internationally, and we really pull way above our weight internationally in sports medicine in Australia. So we're doing very well. We've got a great system here and some great people. So it's good to be able to give them give them an avenue to tell the rest of the world what they're doing, which the textbook does.
That is very true, and I'm glad that you've been able to achieve this and help pave the way for a lot of budding sports physicians as well. So unfortunately, we've only got time for a few more questions. So to finish off, what is some advice you wish someone had told you when embarking upon your medical school and your career?
It's interesting because some people say to me, oh, wow, you've been so lucky and, why you've had all these amazing jobs. And I think, I've been really lucky, it's the right place, right time. But then I also think, I've worked my ass off. I've never sat down at night and watched a television show. I'll always after dinner go and work on a paper or read or do something. And I'm probably a bit. As my wife always says, if she's known I was going to be a workaholic, she would have married me. But and I've spent a lot of time. The biggest message I would give to young people wanting to be sports physicians is to volunteer.
Okay.
To volunteer. I did a lot of volunteering when I started with. Nowadays, there's not a great volunteer culture. And everyone sort of says, well, what am I going to get paid for that? So it's their first question. But now it's a great way to learn. I have first-year interns or even finding medical students with me at the football club I look after, and they learn on the job, and it's terrific. And that's your best way to both to learn and to meet people and to make contacts.
Very true.
So, I guess that's the single one message I would give to people is volunteer and it's like anything else. If you work hard, you'll do okay. But it's not, you don't just sort of rock up and someone gives you a job as the Australian cricket team doctor
or the
Collingwood Football Club doctor or something like that. You've got to earn your stripes like anything else.
Mm-hmm. I know I've got some interested budding sports physicians listening. So for those students listening, what are some volunteering opportunities that they could be involved in?
Well, they should certainly become part of their state sports medicine association, SMA, Sports Medicine Australia.
Okay.
And they provide coverage for all sorts of events, like marathons and triathlons and things like that. And so once you get into that sort of a loop, you can go and observe and help out as sort of first aiders and people.
Yeah.
And then your local footy club or, soccer club or whatever would absolutely love to have a volunteer medical student or intern to help out. But the ones you want to choose are the ones that have good physios.
Yeah.
So get to a club that's got a good physio. Most good amateur clubs will have a physio but not a doctor.
Right.
So and they'll love to have a doctor because, again, you look after the concussions and the suturing and things like that. Mm-hmm. and then you'll manage the injuries with the physios, and you'll learn a heap. So that's a great way of getting experience.
Yeah.
You start coming to conferences, both the annual Sports Medicine Australia conference and the College of Sports Physicians conference.
Yeah.
Get to meet people, talk to people who are in the system, talk to registrars, talk to fellows, and find out what's going on. There's now a very good training program, 4 years on the job training, the same as any other medical specialty.
Yeah.
It's a great career if you love sport or you love activity. And more we're playing the role of exercise advocates.
Yeah.
And we're really the people who understand exercise better than anyone else and promoting that. So, as well as all the glamorous elite sport stuff, we can really play an important role in the sort of general health of the population. So, the one, unfortunately, you certainly won't make a fortune. If you want to make, you want to live in a fancy suburb and drive fancy cars and all that sort of stuff, well, go and do orthopedic surgery. But if you want to have a great experience and love every day of what you do and really help people live healthier lives, sports physicians is a great profession. I would really, I couldn't recommend it more highly. I get up every day and I look forward to the day and look forward to going to work. And if you say that at the end of your career, that you've looked forward to working every single day mm-hmm. that you've been there, then I think you're pretty lucky.
I 100% agree with that statement, and I'm glad you found that for yourself, and hopefully our fellow listeners can also find the career that will also enable them to wake up each morning and be excited. So one final question. So you've been involved with many different sports. Which sport in particular would you say is your favourite sport?
Oh, gee, I get asked.
Bit of a tricky question.
I'm not one of these people who just loves one sport. I love, lots of sports. I mean, cricket was my sport as a youngster. That was my and AFL. They're probably the two, and soccer. And athletics.
it won't stop.
Yeah, I mean, they're probably. Yeah. Ironically, they're the four sports that I've always been most passionate about, and by a bit of luck, really, and a bit of good management, they're the four sports that I've worked out at an elite level, at the highest possible level mm-hmm. that you can work at in all those four sports with Olympic Games and World Cup cricket and AFL Grand Finals and World Cup soccer. So I've been really fortunate. So they're probably the four sports that I've. But the interesting thing is. To be honest, the sport that I most enjoy and the sort of level of sport I most enjoy is not sort of high-level professional sport. It's what I call serious amateur sport. So I had a long involvement with the football club at Melbourne University that I played with for many years, University Blues. I still go down there every Tuesday and Thursday night to training and games on Saturday. And that's the level of sport I really enjoy being involved with because it's not about money. It's about the love of the game, and they take it seriously. Yeah. They train hard. They're very good, but they're not. It's not life and death, and so on. So I really enjoy it. And plus, from my point of view, I feel as though I can make much more of a contribution and really help out. So that I also have an involvement in Premier League with a Premier League hockey team that my kids played for that I'm still involved with. So I really enjoy that sort of level of sporting involvement, but. I'm just a sports tragic. I'm afraid. I can't make any excuses. I'm sorry.
No, that's totally fine. I can relate to that as well. So thank you very much, Peter, for your time today. I've had a lovely chat and I'm sure our listeners are feeling very inspired. I do wish we could continue for several more hours, but unfortunately that is all the time we have for today. So thank you, and I wish you all the best for your future endeavors and the successes of your many sports teams and athletes that you follow as well. So thank you very much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks, Melinda.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the AMSA Ampule podcast Mel 2.0 series. Our code word for this week is TRAM, which if you go to our website, www.m2020.com.au, and insert the code word in our portal, you will go into the running for some great prizes and giveaways. And over the course of our series, we'll be able to collect an image per week for our M20 sticker book. The MEL 2.0 series is a subset of AMPUL, the Australian Medical Students Association's ongoing podcast series, to highlight the speakers who would have presented in our 2020 AMSA National Convention. If you'd like to learn more about our podcast, you can visit our website, www.m2020.com.au, or our parent website, www.amsa.org.au. Or if you prefer, we are on social media as the AMSA AMPUL Podcast, MEL 2.0 Podcast, on Facebook and Instagram. For more information on topics covered in this podcast, you can reach out to AMSA on Facebook, Instagram, and the AMSA website. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the speakers and do not definitively represent those of AMSA or their subsidiaries. If you'd like to know more about our public policies, please visit our website at www.amsa.org.au and select Advocacy, followed by Official Policy. This episode of Ampule was hosted and edited by Melinda Fernando, with guest Dr. Peter Bruckner, and music by James Palmier, and credits by Nick Barry. Thank you. Thank you.